are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 2nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ari Berman of The Nation magazine, author of Give Us the Ballot, on Texas, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Georgia, major ruling in North Carolina in particular, but in those other states, or at least two of them, giving hundreds of thousands of people better access to the ballot. We'll also, later in the program, talk briefly to Brad Herzog, who got fired because of his position on Donald Trump. Meanwhile, U.S. airstrikes in Libya against ISIS. Research shows grocery taxes hurt those living in poverty significantly. No research necessary. Roger Ailes is a monster. Hillary Clinton's big and growing bounce from the convention. And Donald Trump digging his way to China as the first of, I predict, I don't know many, but a couple, GOP congressmen announced they are voting for Hillary Clinton. Not, I'm not voting for Donald Trump. I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. And reports of anthrax being released through the ice in Siberia. Jellyfish inundating the beaches of the UK. And a Zika warning for pregnant women traveling to Miami Beach. And, of course, Al Gore still very fat. All that and more on today's program. No, I say that. That's what you say when, you know, people are talking about global warming. The important thing is that he was not wearing earth tones, according to Maureen Dowd. I don't know what's going on at the New York Times, but between Maureen Dowd and Ross Douthat, Maureen Dowd wrote something. I for the life of me, I tried to read it like five times. I couldn't understand what the heck it was. She was just mad at Barack Obama, I guess, for endorsing Hillary Clinton.
That sounds like a Maureen Dowd column.
Yes. And then a Ross Douthat.
Porn-related?
No. Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a bit of a stretch. We didn't even talk about the Melania Trump thing. Did you talk about that yesterday?
No.
Okay, we'll get to that. Ross Douthat wrote a piece saying that, you know, let's do a thought experiment. Who would be the Trump on the left? Now, here's the point. There can't be a Trump on the left because the left isn't the right. And no one, there is just simply no group of people on the left, in terms of Democrats. The problem isn't with Donald Trump. The problem is with the Republican Party. You know, people are like, I can't believe John McCain. He criticized Trump about what he said about that Gold Star family. But he's still endorsing Donald Trump. John McCain doesn't give two craps. If John McCain had his way, Sarah Palin would be the sitting vice president, probably the Republican nominee, and campaigning with the benefit of incumbency right now. Think about that.
And we'd be wishing for the sober leadership of Donald Trump.
Indeed. he'd probably be the voice of reason right now. Whoa,
calm down, everyone. Look, I'm not going to vote for her, but I can't say I'd vote for Hillary Clinton. Neither. I can't say. I mean, look, you say I vote for Hillary, I won't vote for Sarah Palin. I mean, look, I don't know. You tell me. Exactly.
Meanwhile, we have some big news in the Cedar household. Saul Cedar, now fully sleeping in a big boy's bed. And on top of that, with underwear. Did not pee the bed last night, which is good because he is sleeping on a brand new Casper mattress. Not totally brand new. I mean, but a couple months, like a month. I've talked about Casper in the past. It's the best way to buy a mattress, and it's a great mattress. As you know, mattresses can cost well over $1,500. But Casper mattresses cost $500 for a twin-size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, $950 for a king. And buying a Casper mattress is completely risk-free. They offer free delivery, free returns, with a 100-night home trial. Saul will be, I don't know, like significantly older after that. Like literally, you could measure, like it's 10% of his life, practically. He gets to try out this mattress. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. It is obsessively engineered at a shockingly fair price. It combines springy latex and supportive memory foam to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of the best inventions of 2015. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. You try it for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. I will say this. It's actually sort of cool the way that they, I don't know how they got it in the box, but open up the box, opened up the, it's like vacuum packed, opens up, and it's a heavy, substantial mattress. Don't do it in front of your kid because they're going to say, please do that again. And you can't do it. You do it once and that's it. You can't do it twice. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/majority and using the offer code majority. That's Casper.com/majority. Use the offer code majority. Terms and conditions apply. So, all right, I want to talk briefly about this Melania Trump thing because she is on the cover of the Post. Was it today or yesterday?
I thought it was yesterday. New York Post.
And apparently in 1995 or so, somewhere around then, she did a, risque in this day and age, but she did a nude shoot with another woman. They are lying on top
basically
of each other.
Basically like a JCPenney ad by today's standards.
Honestly, yeah. It's like a JCPenney ad. And I think for, you know, most normal people, they're like, okay. She was a model, or I don't care. Even if she wasn't a model, she's taking nude pictures like
very
that.
Good model.
Who cares? It doesn't matter. But the Post put it on there, and because they will take any opportunity to put scantily clad women or anything that they're selling newspapers. What's fascinating about this, I think, is two things. One, the mainstream media is not going to talk about it that much because. For the most part, it's not that big of a deal. Scantily clad models, two women who are naked with each other. We're now living in the 21st century, and it's just not that big of an issue for normal people. However, Donald Trump is relying on the votes of not normal people, people who still are outraged at the idea that women could lie naked with another woman or woman.
I've got think women here. Too.
Yeah, another, women. Yeah. Or women. Lots, women.
Even worse.
Whatever. And so I think this is going to have real implications for Donald Trump. And we're not going to see it for a couple. I think in a week or two, we're going to see his Republican support drop by 3 or 4 points over this. And I don't think there's any moving off this. I think there's a significant number of evangelicals out there who are just like, we cannot have her in the White House as our first lady because she has lain with another woman. Lawned.
Let's just say lane.
It doesn't matter.
It's not even right, but it sounds good.
And I think this is going to be facet. I think it's going to be the most underreported story because the normal media doesn't want to talk about it because it seems lurid and unfair. And I think it is unfair to judge him based upon that, although that's the way this works.
Oh, you can judge me based off of that. Believe me.
Exactly. I think he's probably like, because this is going to work for me. I mean, it's a pretty hot picture. And... But I think with his more evangelical, it's going to be a problem.
What's the matter with you people?
Big news. Harry's. They have upgraded their razors. I don't know how this is actually possible. I'm not sure I've picked up on this. But there's a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide. A trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places. This is actually good for me. A lubricating strip. A textured handle for more control when it's wet. But it's still just $2 a blade compared to like $4 or more that you'll pay at the drugstore. Harry's Starter's deal is an amazing deal. You get a weighted razor, handle of your choice, whichever one you want, moisturizing shave cream, 3 precision engineered 5-blade cartridges, and a travel cover, all for $15. This is absurd, ladies and gentlemen. But it gets absurder. As you know, Harry's has changed my relationship to shaving. It also, I'm not going to say it changed my relationship with my dad, but I gave him Harry's razor. He's pretty happy. So, I mean, it got marginally better. For a limited time only, there's a special offer for fans of this show. You can get it for less than $15. It's true. Believe me. We've partnered with Harry's to give you $5 off your first purchase with the promo code MajorityReport. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code MajorityReport at checkout. Claim your offer. That's harrys.com, code MajorityReport. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program, in my mind, the most dogged reporter on voting rights over the past 5 years. He is the author of Give Us the Ballot. He writes for The Nation magazine. Ari Berman, welcome back to the program.
Great to see you, Sam. And can I just mention the historic nature of this interview? We talked last year when on the day that my hardcover was published, and today we're talking on the day that my paperback was published. So you're kind of like the white male Jewish Terry Gross for me.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I can't wait for the day that I am actually supplanted by the non-white male Terry Gross, when it's actually Terry Gross. You've been on Terry Gross, haven't you? Has she not interviewed you? That's a huge...
I've been on her. Yes, I was on her. So I can tell my daughter one day that I've been interviewed by Terry Gross and Sam Cedar, and it's just going to blow her mind.
Well, I'll see. Hopefully by then, it'll be the Sam Cedar thing will have it will be up a little bit in value. But be that as it may, Ari. So this is a pretty fortuitous week for your soft cover book to come out. We've had some amazing rulings in the past week. Should we start with North Carolina? Because this seems to be the biggest one.
Yeah, so let me just give you the big picture first before the specifics, that GOP voting restrictions have been struck down in six states in the past 2 weeks. So this is an unbelievable development and a real turning of the tide when it comes to voting rights. And the North Carolina case was the biggest victory, both because North Carolina passed the most sweeping voting restrictions in the country. They didn't just require strict voter ID. They cut back on early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They eliminated pre-registration for 16- and 17-year-olds. And they did so just a month after the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. So that really made the state a poster child for voter suppression efforts. And the court decision by the Fourth Circuit striking it down was remarkable, and I'd urge everyone to read it, because they basically said that this was done intentionally by Republicans to suppress black voters, that the legislature requested all of the data looking at which forms of voting African Americans were more likely to use. And then those were the exact forms of voting they cut back on. And so, for example, they eliminated voting on the Sunday before the election. And the state admitted in court that African American voters were more likely to vote on the Sunday before the election because that's when Souls to the Polls voter mobilization drives were done. So the state basically admitted it was doing this and it would harm black voters and Democratic voters. And the court in North Carolina said that this was as close to a smoking gun as you were ever going to find in modern times.
Literally, that's a quote. We should say.
That's a literal quote from the court, and they said that black voters were targeted with, quote, almost surgical precision. So it was remarkable to see them call out these efforts in such blunt terms.
And let me just quote this. Our conclusion does not mean, and we do not suggest, that any member of the General Assembly harbored racial hatred or animosity toward any minority group, but the totality of the circumstances, North Carolina's history of voting discrimination, the surge in African-American voting, the legislature's knowledge that African-American voting translated into support for one party, and the swift elimination of the tools African-Americans had used to vote and imposition of a new barrier at the first opportunity to do so, cumulatively and unmistakably reveal that the General Assembly used SL 2013-381, that's the laws that rolled back these things, to entrench itself. It did so by targeting voters who, based on race, were unlikely to vote for the majority party. Even if done for a partisan end, that constituted racial discrimination. That, to me, seems huge, right? Because you can no longer, or at least in the context of the Fourth Circuit and maybe until they go to an en banc hearing, you cannot use the idea that, well, you can look at it through a racial lens or you can look at it through a partisan lens. That's no longer a defense.
Yeah, and what is remarkable about this is that intentional discrimination is a very rare finding, that they didn't have to find this.
Ari, you there? Oh, somehow we lost Ari. Hold on for 1 second, folks. Bear with us. Bear with us, folks. Ari, I'm sorry. Okay. We lost you. So you said they didn't have to find this.
I was going to say they didn't have to find intentional discrimination. They just had to find that the law had a discriminatory effect against voters of color. But they went further, and they basically said that that legislatures don't have to say, I'm doing this to disenfranchise black voters or disenfranchise Hispanic voters, if the actions that they take clearly show that that's enough to find that they acted with the full knowledge that these voting laws would harm black voters more than others. And so that's why it was really a remarkable decision by the courts.
And that becomes intent. Now, what's interesting is that, I guess the interesting thing is that they didn't go further, because it seems to me once you determine, right, that there's that they have now defined this as discriminatory intent, even if they're doing it supposedly for partisan purposes, because they know that they're targeting African-Americans because of their likelihood to vote for Democrats. That's discriminatory intent. So why weren't they shoved back in? Let's do it this way. Explain to us when the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. One more time, I know we've done this 100 times on this program, but just remind people how they did so and the concept of preclearance and the sort of like opt-in preclearance measure in Section 3 that could have applied here.
Yeah, so states with a long history of voting discrimination previously had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That is what the Supreme Court struck down. Not the requirement that they had to approve their changes, but the formula that states were covered. So as a result, North Carolina and most of the South and some other states as well no longer have to approve their voting changes. Now there
including, we should say, a couple of counties in New York.
Used part of the Voting Rights Act that says that if you're found guilty of intentional discrimination, you can be what's called bailed back in, meaning that you can once again have to approve your voting changes with the federal government. A court can force you to do that. They decided not to do that for North Carolina. I think that because they blocked this law altogether, they wanted the decision to stand up on appeal. I think they didn't want the full Fourth Circuit to potentially get involved. They didn't want the Supreme Court to potentially get involved. They wanted to get rid of this law before the election and not jeopardize the fact that their ruling might be overturned. That's the best analysis I have for why North Carolina wasn't bailed in.
So just because the court just felt like that would be that would attract more, I guess, scrutiny, or it would create more urgency in terms of trying to appeal it, or what?
Well, I don't know. I didn't interview the judges, so I think we can only speculate. I think they basically thought that this was an extremely strongly worded ruling. It blocked everything immediately, because sometimes these laws are kept in place pending an appeal. But right now, the law is struck down pending an appeal, which is great for voters. And I think that basically they felt like this was a very strong message to the North Carolina legislature: don't do this again. And if you do it again, we're going to come right back at you. And they didn't need to bail them in, because this decision would hopefully be a deterrent. Now, I'm still concerned about what states like North Carolina are going to do in the future. I should mention that already we've seen local jurisdictions in North Carolina shutting down polling places on majority black campuses, for example, shutting down polling places in Democratic neighborhoods. So there's a lot they can still do, a lot of mischief they can still do on the local level. But right now, really, the most sweeping voting restrictions in the country have been overturned.
Okay, before we talk about where the defendants can, where the state can go after this, and if there's an opportunity for to shove them back into sort of preclearance by other means, what is it? I mean, give me a sense of what people calculate this means in terms of votes in North Carolina. I mean, just how many are we talking? Like, 10,000 people, 5,000 people. I mean, how many people are we talking about who now have an easier who people project? How much will this impact the actual vote number of votes that people will cast?
Hundreds of thousands of people use these reforms. So 700,000 people voted during the first week of early voting, which was eliminated by the state. 120,000 people used same-day voter registration in 2012, which was eliminated by the state. Many people used out-of-precinct voting. Let's say you're a factory worker, you work a long day on your shift, you want to go vote where you work, not where you live. That's something that's very common for people. 200,000 voters in the state didn't have strict forms of government issued ID. So a lot of people are affected by this. And remember, Barack Obama won North Carolina by 14,000 votes in 2008. So certainly a much larger number than 14,000 people are impacted by the fact that all of these restrictions have been struck down.
And the ruling also did something else, which I thought was really important too. It said it's irrelevant as to whether or not, even with these rollbacks, North Carolina has laws that are more favorable to voting. And so in other words, North Carolina instituted a lot of reforms that made voting easier than in most states, right? Like most states don't necessarily have early voting or don't have these other things, but it's measured against this ruling is measured against where North Carolina was on the day that these restrictions were imposed, as opposed to some type of baseline.
That's a really, really good point that you just brought up, because North Carolina has been making this argument in court that, well, New York doesn't have early voting. New York doesn't have same-day registration, so why should we have it? Well, people in North Carolina have no idea what the law is in New York. They only know what the law was in their state. And when their laws become more burdensome, people are impacted by it. I have told stories of voters who were not able to vote because they showed up and thought they could register before the election. They were no longer able to because the state eliminated same-day registration. I told stories of people who showed up at a different polling place and were not able to vote because they weren't at their correct precinct. I told stories of people that were turned away from the polls because they didn't have strict forms of government-issued ID that are not accepted by the state. So there was lots of different reasons why people were turned away. And I would love for New York to have early voting. I would love to for New York to have same-day registration. But New York has not been suppressing voters in the way that North Carolina has historically. And not only that, but what New York is doing really is totally irrelevant to what's happening in North Carolina. So I think the baseline, as you mentioned, should be what the law is in these states and whether there's a good reason to make it harder to vote. And the court in North Carolina said there was no good reason to make it harder to vote. There was no compelling evidence of voter fraud. The law would stop. This was done instead to try to disenfranchise African-American voters who are the strongest base of the Democratic Party in North Carolina and across the country.
And we should also say in that respect, they found that to the extent that there was any type of voter fraud taking place, none of it was in person. To the extent that there was any, it was done by absentee ballots, which, of course, is taken advantage of more by white Republicans, whereas blacks generally and Democrats vote in person. And so in terms of absentee ballots, you have no voter ID requirement. And that became an element of evidence, right?
Like it did. Under the guise of stopping voter fraud, in fact, North Carolina made voter fraud more common because they required strict forms of ID in person where voter fraud is virtually non-existent. And they didn't allow require ID for absentee ballots where voter fraud is more common. Still not that common, but certainly more common than in person. And they did that because there's clear data showing that Democratic voters and African-American voters are more likely to vote in person, whereas white voters and Republican voters, particularly elderly voters, are more likely to vote absentee. And so that one stat right there just shows you that this law has nothing to do with voter fraud, that if you were trying to deal with voter fraud, you would immediately start with absentee ballots, not exempt absentee ballots and then make fraud more common.
Okay, so let's move from the Fourth Circuit, which, of course, this holding, it involves North Carolina. This is Fourth Circuit deals with South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia as well, but it doesn't necessarily have any implications there, although we get a sense of what's going on here. Where could the plaintiffs go after this? Okay, so this was a three-judge panel? This is the way that circuit courts do this, folks. They have a three-judge panel right now. If the defendant wants to go further, they can go to the en banc, which is the entire court. And that may be trickier, right?
They could, although, like I said, the law is blocked right now. So the time is not on the side of North Carolina. Right now, the voters are the ones who benefit from any sort of drawn-out process because the law is actually blocked, which is a reversal of what we've seen in other states like Texas, where these laws have been in effect pending court challenges and everything just took like forever to be heard. The Fourth Circuit is still a circuit that has more Democratic appointees than Republican appointees, so I don't think they would overrule a unanimous opinion by a lower court. Because it wasn't a divided opinion, it was unanimous opinion. The other thing is that I don't think the Supreme Court's going to hear this, because the Supreme Court is deadlocked 4-4, and I don't see 5 votes for overturning this. So I think that most likely, you never know, but I think most likely this law is going to stand, and the fact that Justice Scalia is no longer here really has changed the entire dynamics when it comes to the Supreme Court and voting rights and pretty much every other issue as well.
My one hope when I pass on is that I am not consistently referenced in the context of conversation saying it's a good thing for people's rights, it's a good thing for all good things, my death is no my being alive is not going to prevent good things from happening.
No, that's, you'll be like a reverse Scalia when like you pass away. I'll be like, remember when Sam was here? Like things were just so much better.
Well,
it'll be like how people talk about the 1950s.
I appreciate that, I think, Ari. All right, let's go. Let's talk about Wisconsin, because in the same week, we see an equally significant case, you tell me, in Wisconsin.
Not quite as significant, but pretty significant. So Wisconsin, like North Carolina, not only passed a strict ID law, but they passed a lot of other under-the-radar voting restrictions. Like they eliminated early voting on nights and weekends, which is my favorite because like that's they eliminated early voting on the exact times when people would be most likely to use it.
Right.
And they made it harder to register to vote. They made it harder to cast absentee ballots. A bunch of these restrictions were overturned, and the voter ID law was also softened. So basically, the two different courts said that the voter ID law, number one, has to be expanded to include more acceptable IDs like student IDs, and also that people have to have some sort of safety net. So if they don't have ID, they can still be able to vote. It's not as significant as North Carolina because they didn't strike it down altogether. But it's significant in that they made that part of the law easier for voters, and they struck down all of these other things. And like in North Carolina, the Wisconsin court said that the early voting restrictions in particular were done to, quote, suppress the reliably Democratic vote of African Americans in Milwaukee. So, I mean, within literally like 3 hours apart of each other, we have two court decisions that found that GOP legislatures were clearly restricting voting rights to intentionally target black voters.
And I guess the Texas one we had earlier, but just remind us of what's going on with Texas.
So what the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the full Fifth Circuit, ruled in a decision written by a George W. Bush appointee, a very conservative court, ruled that the Texas voter ID law discriminated against black and Hispanic voters. Now, the ruling itself was really good. The remedy was less good, because they basically said that even though this law is discriminatory, it should remain in effect, but there has to be some sort of provision for those without ID to still be able to vote, whether that's signing an affidavit or whether that's being able to vote with a voter registration card. I would have liked to see them throw the law out altogether. I don't know how you can conclude that something is discriminatory and then leave it in place with a safety net. That really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But nonetheless, for a conservative court to rule this way was still pretty significant.
Okay, so we've got, by my count, three more. Is that right? Three more major decisions in the past 2 weeks.
A ban on straight ticket voting was overturned in Michigan. That's important because there's data showing that Democratic voters and voters of color were more likely to use straight ticket voting. When you eliminate it, it leads to longer lines. And actually, places like Detroit had 3 to 4 hour lines already.
What does that mean? How do you ban how people can vote? I don't even understand that.
Well, it's just, I mean, there's different evidence for wanting to get rid of straight ticket voting, but this was something that was clearly done in Michigan to target black voters in Detroit, and that's why the courts overturned it. So that was one thing that was gotten
rid of. Explain this to me. Is it like you get into the booth and there's a button that says you vote all Democrat or all Republican?
Yeah, we have that in New York. You can just say, I want to vote for the Democratic ticket, and bam, then you vote for every Democrat.
All right. Well, I fill mine in with pencil.
And I know you're going to do straight green, so it doesn't really matter. But for other people,
if they had a comptroller running, I would do that. But all right. So that's in Michigan. And in Kansas, we had a ruling as well.
Yeah, so Kansas, this is so complicated. I just want to briefly mention what Kansas did. But basically, Kansas has a required proof of citizenship for voter registration, meaning you have to show, you can't just attest your U.S. citizen. You have to show a birth certificate or a passport or naturalization papers, which the vast majority of people don't have on them when they register, including at the DMV. Then the court said that Kansas has to register these people, which is 17,000 voters who registered at the DMV. Then Kansas said that, okay, they were going to let these people vote, but only in only in federal elections, not state and local elections. And the court was like, what are you talking about? Like, you're either registered to vote or you're not registered to vote. People have to be able to vote in all elections. So they said 17,000 people can vote in all elections, state, federal, and local elections. And Kansas is just one of these states where the Secretary of State there, Kris Kobach, has been probably the most dogged advocate of restricting voting rights. And this is, I haven't calculated it, but this seems like this is about the 10th court decision against him in the last few years. And then the last thing was in North Dakota. They struck down the voter ID law there for discriminating against Native American voters.
So are we seeing all these cases? I mean, to what extent does the Supreme Court, does Antonin Scalia's death, does the Supreme Court being at 4-4 with at least this vague notion that, you know, it's very possible we're going to get a flip on the court. And I imagine, I mean, the North Carolina thing is pretty much a rebuke to John Roberts, isn't it? Like, is John Roberts
a huge rebuke to John Roberts. John Roberts said voting discrimination was a thing of the past. And then a month later, North Carolina passed a law that intentionally discriminated against black voters. And basically the Fourth Circuit said that. And they kind of called out Roberts by name without directly addressing him. And these decisions, to me, are not evidence that the Voting Rights Act is not needed. They're evidence that the Voting Rights Act is needed because there's clear evidence that discrimination is still occurring.
Because we at least had one election when these restrictions were in place, right? Or North Carolina, or no?
We had some of these restrictions, not all of them, were in place in 2014, and people were turned away from the polls. Some of these restrictions were in place in 2016, and people were turned away from the polls. And just to strike this law down took millions of dollars. It took intervention from the Justice Department, from the biggest civil rights groups in the country. Meanwhile, people that were turned away from the polls, they can't get that election back.
Right.
They can't get their disenfranchisement back. Elections were undertaken. Critical elections, like a Senate election in 2014, under these laws, that you have to wonder about now how legitimate some of those elections were in the first place. But basically, the fact is that this law, if the Voting Rights Act had not have been gutted, would never have become law because it would have been blocked before it even took effect by the federal courts or the Justice Department.
Ari, as much as you know, I don't know if this is in your portfolio to answer this question, but do you think that these courts, particularly in North Carolina, but also arguably, I guess, in Wisconsin as well, would have been this aggressive in the event that Scalia was still alive? In other words, like, if you're a court, do you make such a sweeping finding knowing that this could go up? I mean, if it was 5-4, Scalia was alive. Literally, right? North Carolina could today file, we need an injunction from the Supreme Court.
Brief. Yeah. 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 And there's a good chance they would get it.
So do you think that the judges, when they make this ruling, they sort of feel like,
Here's what I will say.
Dad's out of town permanently?
I don't know if that's the case, but I think these courts do know that they might be the last resort, and so they're making their decisions as emphatic as possible. And I think that's why when in the Texas case, for example, the voter ID case, that's why you saw a 200-page opinion, because everyone wanted to get their points of view there, knowing that it was likely the Supreme Court was not going to be able to hear the case. So I think that Scalia's death has really changed things. I think the reason that these laws are also being struck down is that these are really bad laws that are among the worst laws in the country, and that the courts know that we're heading towards an election and that they have to be ruled on so people have enough time to be able to vote. And so I don't think, like, people are saying, well, oh, it's they're responding to Trump. And it has nothing to do with Donald Trump.
All these cases
started. It has to do with the
fact
that these are bad laws that need to be heard and decided on before the election, before it's too late.
What, as of today, now that the North Carolina is struck down, what is now the worst sort of, I guess, repressive restrictions on the vote around the country, broadly speaking?
So I've been thinking about this a lot. I mean, you know, I'm still, even though there's a safety net, I'm still very concerned about the voter ID laws in Texas and Wisconsin, because I don't have any confidence that the state is going to do any education to let people know that they don't need strict ID to vote. I think that you're going to hear Scott Walker and Greg Abbott and all these people say you need ID to vote, which is not true. So I'm still really concerned about those states. You still have states like Virginia that not only have a strict voter ID law, but they just the court in Virginia just reversed Terry McAuliffe's executive order giving voting rights back to 200,000 ex-felons. So I'm concerned about that.
He's going to sign each one
in Ohio. So there's a bunch of different states where there's still things that are ongoing that are potentially problematic.
Ari Berman, nobody knows this stuff better than you, and it's a real treat and honor to have you on to talk about it. Folks, nothing like taking a book to the beach, and now that it's on soft cover, give us the ballot. I mean, you read that on the beach. It's like basically walking on the beach and just saying, you know, I mean, it's just you're projecting a certain air of sophistication.
Yeah, it's like nerd Baywatch if you take it to the beach.
That's a great way of saying that. Unfortunately, I'm not sure a lot of people remember Baywatch. But Ari Berman, nevertheless, you're like the hulking, you know, 190-pound guy on the beach with the book kicking sand in all the other people's faces. All right.
Just because I had a baby doesn't mean that I gained that much weight.
Oh, you will, buddy. Believe me. That's what happens. Ari Berman.
Once I have two. Okay.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Great to talk to you. Talk to you soon.
All right, folks. We're going to put a link up to on the site to give us the ballot. Check out this book. It gives you the history of the Voting Rights Act. And this is going to be a big issue going forward. I should also say, while we're talking about this in North Carolina, well, you know what? I'll get to that later. I'm one of the things that really excited me about that North Carolina ruling, and we'll talk about it later, is that it cited, I don't know if it actually cited him per se, but something that, you know, sort of an old buddy of mine did on a comedy show. I will express that later. But right now, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Brad Herzog about a story that it came to my attention in two different directions, and so I wanted to have him on to talk about it briefly. It involves Trump. It involves recreational vehicles. What better? What better tease? We'll be right back in just 1 minute. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Well, I should say this. Like about a week or two ago, a couple weeks ago, I don't go on Facebook that much at all. I don't go on Facebook. And Lawyer Matthew sent me something. He said, this is a great story. I know this guy. And then I heard from Cliff Schechter, who said the same thing. I don't know if he saw it on Facebook, too. And so we decided to have him on. Brad Herzog is an author and was a spokesman for the recreational vehicle industry, and now he's just an author, which is not just a just. I mean, you've written close to, what is it, a couple of dozen books. Is that right, Brad?
Yeah, 35 or 40. I kind of lost count after a while.
So you've written these books, and you started, from what I gather, you started in to become an RV industry spokesperson, you and your wife, because you were a travel writer. And then tell us just how that happened.
Well, I've written a bunch of children's books and various books, but I've also written three American travel memoirs. And when my first one got a lot of attention, it was a book called States of Mind. And I did some TV interviews, and I looked comfortable on TV. My wife Amy and I got hired as summer traveling ambassadors, essentially, for the RV Industry Association, because we had traveled around for a year in a Winnebago to write my first book. And then we were rehired. It's a year-by-year contract, but we were rehired 16 summers in a row, and our job was to travel around for a couple of months, set up a bunch of local TV interviews, you know, Good Morning Omaha, that type of thing, and just talk about how much fun we're having and the joys and wonders of traveling in an RV. And for more than 300 interviews over those 17, 16-plus summers, all we talked about and nothing else was you know, how great it is to travel around in a house on wheels. And in my side, on the side during those 17 years, I wrote maybe 25, wrote and published 25 or so books. But it was my latest book that got us fired.
So, all right. So walk me through this. It seemed to happen so quick because you hadn't even written the book yet, right? I mean, is that right?
Well, we had written, I wrote this book. This book is called, I've written a lot of alphabet books for kids about baseball and how to protect the planet and that sort of thing. So my wife and I, inspired by our disgust at the way Donald Trump scapegoats people and entire segments of the population and fights, you know, freedom of expression and has a reactionary response to everything. As a result of that, we wrote a book called D is for Dump Trump, an anti-hate alphabet. It's 26 poems and about 20 editorial cartoons.
Hold on, wait. Did you say anti-hate? That is pretty controversial stuff. That anybody would be promoting anti-hate.
We wrote it. We sort of did a print on demand, and our friends and family mostly bought it, and we got some great response. So we started a Kickstarter campaign to try and raise $7,500 to print it more broadly. I mean, this is a tiny Kickstarter campaign that we started. And it happened that the campaign started on June 28th, while we had already done about four TV interviews for the RV people in San Diego, LA, Tucson. And,
So let me get this straight. So you start in the summer, you head out on the road, and, so you were like, I guess in the, I don't know, the first, eighth of your summer job, essentially, with them.
Right. And we had done these interviews where, you know, I did 9 minutes in Tucson, which is a really long local TV interview. Never in any of our interviews have we ever or would we ever promote any agenda beyond political or otherwise beyond, you know, promoting the RV experience. That we would be stupid to do that. We're paid to promote RVing. I wouldn't go on TV then representing them and actually spout something, some political rhetoric.
Or even you never did in the past get on like last year, or the year before and say, yeah, I'm also writing a kid's book. You can buy it here or anything like that.
Well, if they asked about my travel memoirs, I would talk about that because that was relevant to what we were doing. You know, I would talk about how it's such a great way to get to the nooks and crannies of the country. I mean, I could do these talking points in my sleep at this point. That we did, and with genuineness. I mean, we truly loved traveling around and still would love to in an RV. But nothing, you know, I also wrote hundreds of thousands, you know, 6 years of blog posts on their behalf, hundreds of thousands of words, nothing political in there. And by the way, once we were, I know we're going to get to that in a second, but once we were fired, the most chilling thing to me is that they've scrubbed my 6 years of blog posts from their website. They're gone. It's like I don't exist anymore. It's very sort of McCarthy-esque, you know. It's frightening. So we did these interviews, and then on June 28th, the Kickstarter campaign launched. So our book, D is for Dump Trump, was not for sale on Amazon. It's not even on my website. You can't be selling anything while you're doing a Kickstarter campaign for it. And then somehow someone from our personal email list contacted this fellow named Greg Gerber, who is the founder and publisher and editor of the RV Daily Report, which is sort of an industry newsletter that has been described to us within the industry as sort of the National Enquirer of the RV industry, if you can imagine that.
I can't.
And he, within 2 hours of our Kickstarter launch, having not talked to us, having not done any research beyond, must have been minutes of research, he wrote this sort of incendiary, quote, opinion piece talking about how the RVIA, the RV Industry Association, should disavow their affiliations with these authors who are clearly going to be promoting their political point of view by using their TV platform. And then he went on for a couple paragraphs after that to defame how we were publishing the book. He said, his line was, "I don't know why these California liberals need other people's money to publish a book." And that created a little firestorm that, I mean, there's a whole series of sort of 12-step Trumpism process that happened here. You know, disguise your agenda, learn nothing, ignore the facts, attack freedom of expression, use innuendo as a weapon, scapegoat the powerless, you know, inflame the uninformed. It goes on and on, you know. Within 24 hours, after 17 years of working for this group and getting an award 10 years ago called the Spirit of America Award, that they have also given to, like, Matthew McConaughey and other people, after 17 years without even a phone call or asking to see our book or watching any of our TV clips from this summer, we were terminated. Our contract was terminated.
So how did someone from your personal email list sent it to Greg Gerber? Do you think they were doing that because they were trying to narc on you, or do you think it was more like they were hoping that this guy would promote it?
Well, I don't want to use innuendo myself in this situation, so yeah. I can't be sure what happened. We suspect that it was someone, and we're pretty certain of this, but we're not sure, that it was a particular guy on our list who used to, who has an axe to grind with the RV Industry Association, and is very pro-Trump.
What? What's going on with this RV wars? That someone has an axe to grind with the RV.
Well, I believe he used to get a lot of money from them for what he was doing, and now he doesn't anymore.
Wow.
But I don't want to sort of be too specific about that guy because I would hate to be accused of kind of.
I understand. I'm quite confident that nobody who's listening to this has any idea.
Right.
So
I think the worlds don't overlap much. I'm like the one overlap on the Venn diagram of those two worlds.
So have you talked to, like, did you have talked to any of the people? I mean, you've been working for them for 17 years. I would imagine you have some, you know, I mean, I try and keep at arm's length with all the people that I work with. But I would imagine after 17 years, you would have some, like, call up somebody on the phone, Bill or Mary, and just be like, seriously?
Well, we talked to one guy there who told us what was going on. We weren't even aware of this little firestorm that was going on. We don't read this RV Daily report. I don't know why people do, but I wrote an email to the sort of decision makers, to a couple of people, saying, you know, please don't be reactionary about this. Obviously, we would never do anything political. This is such an unfair, incendiary story. He didn't get any of the facts right. You know, he didn't even state that I've written 30 other books. You know, it was all hypotheticals about how we were going to be ambushed on local TV, and which is the funniest part of this, chilling and funny, because he basically wrote this hypothetical that these people were going to ambush us because they were going to find out about our political book and ask about that instead. And I don't know if you've been on a lot of local TV, but, you know, our typical scenario was that some, you know, 24-year-old reporter on Good Morning Fresno is coming out, rushing out to our RV with our press release, reading our press release for the first time to do a 3.5-minute puff piece about RV travel. The notion that that person would somehow morph into Mike Wallace is just so laughable.
Of course.
That was the hypothetical that this guy used.
And
they bought it. They took the bait.
Well, the amazing thing is he did it. I mean, to the extent, like, how would that ambush happen, right? I mean, he did it, but it, at least if that, budding, Woodward and Bernstein coming out to break the case of the RV industry spokespeople who wrote a book about Trump, you would just say, we don't want to talk about it.
Right. I said that to the guy when he fired us. I said, he said to me, you can't control what they're going to ask you. And I said, well, I can control what I'm going to answer. You know, it's such an absurd concept. But then now they claim their statement that RVIA put out was that their whole mission is to be apolitical.
That's their whole mission?
That's sort of their, well, that's what their core message is, of neutrality, political neutrality.
It's not go out and go into a recreational vehicle?
Well, I suppose that's really their core mission.
I mean, but I would
think their core political mission. Neutrality thing is bizarre, too, because I'll just tell you that this Spirit of America award that Amy and I won in, I think, 2006, you know, it was described as, you know, about how we it recognizes prominent Americans for their extraordinary dedication to the values of freedom espoused by the RV industry. Well, 2 years before they gave it to us, you could look on their website. They list all their recipients. They don't list one guy who actually did receive it 2 years before us, and that was Justice Clarence Thomas.
Mm.
And when he received it, it's not listed on their website. But when he received it, the board chairman of RVIA recognized his quote him as an exemplary representative of the traditional American values inherent to RV travel and camping. To me, that's code.
Well, I would also imagine that the RV industry is pretty strongly in favor of maintaining our state and federal parks. I would imagine that's pretty important to their industry, right? And things.
Well, also, the industry has done incredibly well under President Obama, by the way. It's, you know, shipments are up more now than they've been in a decade, and it's doing very well right now.
Why is that? People wanting to get on the road more? Or?
I think it's a good indicator of economic health, actually. I think it's sort of a discretionary choice for a lot of people, and I think when the economy is starting to do better, the industry does better. And by the way, the 6 days after they terminated our contract, they gave a national award to Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa, who spoke at the RNC on day one and criticized how you can't trust Hillary and all that. 6 days after they fired us, they gave her an award. I think she's on the RV caucus, which is, I don't know exactly what that is, but it doesn't seem to convey political neutrality to me. So I think what happened was a lot of Trumpers didn't like the fact that we wrote a book called D is for Dump Trump, and their membership, they were scared by their membership's vitriol about it and their misconstruing of misinformation, and they reacted, I don't want to use the word cowardly, but you can if you want.
Cowardly.
but they reacted in within 24 hours.
Wow.
In a very, you know, showed no loyalty whatsoever. And I think it conveys to us, it was a reminder that, you know, we wrote this book because we feel like Trump is such a dangerous person. But, you know, we realize now that the problem is far more profound. It's not just about the man. It's about the message and the modeling and the, you know, his momentum and, the, you know.
And the people who support
Trump,
him.
You know, this Trumpism is the poison that killed us.
Yep. I agree with you. Well, people, we have a link to your Kickstarter, so people can and people can buy the book through the Kickstarter. I mean, how does this work?
Well, it's the Kickstarter campaign ends in about 45 hours or so. You pre-purchase the book. We have T-shirts, we have the book, we have other offerings, and you're supporting the campaign, you're supporting the project, and you're pre-purchasing a book for another 45 hours or so.
And I should say, you guys just lost half of your annual income, didn't you?
We lost, if you add it all up for the next 10 years, if we were rehired, which we figured we would be, we probably lost, you know, like $750,000.
Wow.
I mean, it's an incredible blow to us. But the Kickstarter campaign is doing great. When this story came out, we had 17 backers on Kickstarter. When we were fired, we had like 52 backers. Now we have about 920.
Oh, that's great.
So people from all around the world, by the way. So people are really, you know, pissed off about this story, and they're showing it.
Well, I am burning my RVIA card right now. No more belonging to the Recreational Vehicle Industry Association for me. So
you're going to have to sell your RV, I guess, huh?
Well, I'll buy one first, and then I'll sell it. Brad Herzog, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
All right. So there you have it. It does sound a little bit like a Christopher Guest movie, right? Like all this intrigue. Did you ever see that documentary about the RV? There was a guy who did. I mean, they used to hand out, we used to pass these around in VHS tapes, and I remember seeing it. but somebody did a movie of this RV guy who would do ads. I can't remember what it is now. It's called Winnebago Man, I think it is. And the guy was a very angry dude, and he would just yell. They were doing these, like, they were doing, you know, industrials to promote the RVs. And the guy would just, like, just have these huge, massive fits about, like, you're not shooting this right, you effing beep, 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 beep. I mean, like, in the Winnebago Man, they tracked him down. It's a great documentary. It's not related to Brad, but check that out. We have a link to the Kickstarter if you want to buy an alphabet picture book. It's got 26 poems, 20 editorial cartoons, and you're also, I don't know, send a letter to Greg, whatever that guy's name is. What a jerk. Greg Gerber. How dare they sully the RVIA? It really does sound like a...
Danny McBride, isn't it?
All right, we got to take a break. We're going to head into the fun half, and wherein we'll talk about that that Daily Show segment, which was cited in the footnotes, to be fair, of the North Carolina case. That to me is just unbelievable. It's so awesome. Donald Trump was on Sean Hannity last night, and Donald Trump was very worried about the integrity of the election, because I think Donald Trump is starting to realize, like, I'm going to lose, and I need to actually come up with a litany of excuses as to what's going on.
I need an exit plan.
Hey, yeah.
It's true.
New York Times doesn't write good. we'll talk about all that and more. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. If you want to be a part of the program, I will turn on the IMs right now. Folks, just a reminder, and I don't know what it is. We've lost a couple of members because of the primary still. Someone just sent me an email, said, I want to cancel. I guess I'm ridiculous, which I think must be a reference to what Sarah Silverman said. I want to tell you I didn't tell her to say that.
In your face.
We barely talk anymore, if that makes people feel better. If you do have the means and you enjoy listening to the program on a regular basis, please, by all means, become a member today. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com and become a member. If you don't want to spend the 30 cents a day to support the program, but you buy crap from Amazon, do it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. If you don't like Amazon, but you like to buy stuff online, buy it through our link from jet.com at majorityreportkickback.com. If you drink coffee, and you must all drink coffee, every time you buy from justcoffee.coop, you're not only buying fair trade coffee from a co-op, from people who supported the Wisconsin union protests, you're not only getting, if you want, organic, they have all sorts of different types of coffees, but you're also supporting the program. And you can get a Majority Report blend, which is a delicious blend. And it also makes it for a great gift. So it's justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Quick break, right back. See you in the fun half.